Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sweaty sack summer is approaching, and it's time for you to prioritise the comfort of your crotch. That's why the kings of crotch comfort, Manscaped, have spent 2 years designing the most comfortable boxer briefs ever. I've had the honour of testing out these new boxers, and I can say they have very soft fabric, the softest of any underwear. So breathable, you will love them. They even trademark the dual pouch, so you know it's serious. I think it's time to invest in your family jewels. So get 20% off plus free shipping by using the code ONION at manscaped.com.
Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code ONION at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code ONION at manscaped.com.
Harmonize with me and hold me tight all through the night. You're shining bright. I'm your oyster, baby. You're my pearl.
Hey, what? Billy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm just here. I'm very, very close to your ear hole.
We just got this new webcam. Now, you're the kind of tech guy out of the two of us. Just checking the webcam's working. They said you have to be right in the centre of the frame. How is it good?
Could you take one step back? One more step back. One more step back. One more step back.
You look fantastic, Dom. Have you had a haircut? Have you had a haircut?
I got a haircut today. What do you think? We're calling it military punk.
I love it. And might I say, that is a fine moustache.
Well, thank you. We're going to get into the moustache and the reason why I have the moustache in a second. But I know you're in the middle of a job right now, so you don't have the freedom of haircuts. But I would say when you get out of this job responsibility, maybe we can be haircut twins. Because I think you could rock this haircut amazingly.
I'd love my hair to look like that. But at the moment, I'm in sort of 19th century North America. So I thrust my hair thusly forward. The hair people do that in the mornings.
Right.
What do you think of that?
Quite good. Quite kind of Noel Gallagher, Liam Gallagher-esque. How does it feel to be in that period of history? You can't really reveal a huge amount about what you're doing, but you play quite a dastardly character, don't you?
Yeah, he's not the nicest guy, to be honest, Tom. And at that time, there was a lot of people who were not very nice like that. And what's really concerning, there's still some people these days that are not very nice like that.
Yeah.
Treating human beings not like human beings.
Yeah. Are you still in a place, because we in our industry, we have times where we can and can't reveal stuff. Are you still in a place where you can't necessarily say what this job is that you're doing?
I think I can say that it is Washington Black. So it is based on that novel, that wonderful novel.
Oh, brilliant. Black.
And which you've read, haven't you?
My second favourite book that I read last year. I read two books very fast on set last year. The first one was called All the Light We Cannot See, which is a beautiful book about two young kids going through the Second World War. And then the second one, bought for me by my amazing makeup artist, Aisling Duffy, was Washington Black, and I was charmed by it. The whole world, beautiful, and what a great character, Washington Black.
Isn't it lovely? And the actors playing Washington Black, because there is more than one as it goes through quite a lot of time, are both wonderful, beautiful young actors, and both great. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing this one, Dom, and it's been great fun. And I'm up in Nova Scotia, Scotland.
New Scotland, and you've been very impressed by Nova Scotia. I've never been, but you recommend it highly, don't you?
Yeah, I've been here a few times now, and the last time I was here, Just outside Halifax, there's a place called Dartmouth. And this is one of my favourite t-shirts. Look at this though.
Dartmouth is pretty nice.
That's quite Canadian, isn't it? Dartmouth is pretty nice.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, let's not go too much here. I love it. It's a lovely place, Dom. You'd love it.
I can't wait to see. I know it's kind of a place of the great outdoors and can get a little cold in the winter and stuff. But from a culinary point of view, what is it that Nova Scotia do better than anywhere else? Are they really good for a certain type of wine or a fish dish or
seafood, Dom?
Yeah, I'll seafood.
They love their seafood. They love it here and it's absolutely delicious. And if there was one thing that I think we all try to find, and if you go to a new part of town or you go to a new little village or whatever, a lobster roll. Everyone seems to, that's where you get the best lobster roll, they'll say. Mm. So that's how you pick a good restaurant or a bad one. And a lobster roll is delicious.
I imagine.
It's like, it's almost like a
roll of lobster.
No, it's like lobster in some bread. But the bread is normally like toasted with butter. Ooh. And then, oh, Dom, with some lemon on it.
Oh, the
song of the lobster roll. And that's what they all sing.
Brilliant. You're like a local.
And you'll hear that up and down the streets of Halifax.
You recently had COVID, William. Recently had COVID.
Dom, I did. I received that into my body somehow. And I had to go and quarantine for 8 days. I found myself, Dom.
Right.
But then I lost myself again about day
four. Yeah.
But actually, it was good. The production said, oh, you've got COVID. Get out.
Stop
me in a little cottage next to a lake. Ooh. Maybe like, remember that movie Misery? Sort of like that.
Mm-hmm.
But without anybody there breaking my ankles or that, which was good.
Good.
So, and it was actually quite nice. I just kind of, the weather was quite nice. I didn't feel too bad. A couple of days of head cold. Quite a lot of League of Legends.
Yes, quite a lot of League of Legends.
I read quite a lot.
Mm.
And listened to music. It was actually all right.
Okay. You seemed to exhibit very similar symptoms to my dad, which was a little bit of a dry, scratchy throat, kind of, and slightly under the weather, but kind of hard to define how you're under the weather. Just a bit kind of.
Yeah, just a bit. Oh. But when I came back and I did my first day's work, I got in the car to come back to the hotel and I thought, I'm going to go out for dinner tonight. Looking forward to it. And when I got to the hotel, not an ounce of energy did I have.
Ooh.
I couldn't have went for dinner. I didn't have the energy to make my jaw open and close
in a
chewing manner. So I went straight to bed, Dom. I was exhausted. It takes it out of you.
It does take it out of you. Did you call the production and ask for possibly an AD to come over, and while you were taking small inhalations in while you were breathing, just drop little pieces of lobster roll into your mouth. So you go, poof.
That would be lovely.
Be a good one.
You could choke and die, perhaps.
You could.
Yeah, I couldn't get out that night. But I'm feeling pretty much 100% again.
Two things. I like to use numbers in a slightly unorthodox way, because normally I would do that. Peace. But I'm doing that, which is a fun one. Two things, Billy. First of all, yes, we did play League of Legends. You ended up playing really good League of Legends while you had COVID. So maybe you should consider having COVID again, because you were quite good at League of Legends during that. But one of the things that I'm happy that you've left behind now is during League of Legends, while you had COVID, you were still having that throaty thing. And every so often when we were playing in different parts of the map, you would go, and I was like, oh my god, what's going on with Billy? And I was like, that's right, he's got COVID. But it was terrifying every time he did it.
That was very Very kind of you, Dom, not to bring that up when we were playing. That kind of made me feel bad. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was good. There was a lot of good games during that time. It was fun.
Yeah, you were playing excellent League of Legends. And then the second thing, number two, is that I remember when you actually did start to feel fully human, you took yourself down for a slap-up seafood meal, didn't you? Took pictures of it and everything. Scallops and oysters and, oh, my God.
My God, that was lovely. That was like my second day out, wasn't it? And I thought, I'm going to get a lunch. And I saw this place. I suppose we were in a little town called...
He's not frozen. He's just thinking.
Forgot the name of it, but it might come back to me. And it's just starting to open up for the season, you know? So little restaurants would open up sort of every couple of days or whatever. And I saw this place and it was fantastic. And I thought, I need to send this to the boys, being the hobbits. Because as we know, Dom, and this was your idea, as we're doing this little tour of conventions this year, and first time ever that all four hobbits have done that, Dom had the idea that whatever city we're in, Dallas, whatever, Orlando, that we go to a nice restaurant and we have a nice evening together. And we've been doing that. And that's what made me think when I went there and I got these lovely oysters, I thought, I'm going to send a picture to the boys, see what they think of this.
Yeah,
it was a lovely, because I'd been in the house having tins of soup and stuff for 8 days. It was nice to kind of splurge out a little bit.
Peeling the onion.
I think we might have time for one housekeeping thing, especially since this is in regards to the tap paradox or the faucet paradox that we talked about last week. So I'm going to read this out.
Go on.
This is from a YouTube user whose name is Another Postcard. That's what their name is on YouTube. Nice. Says, to answer Dom's question, the answer is surface tension. Each separate little body of water has this thing called surface tension that, in a way, acts as a barrier to the world outside the drop. When that barrier is touched by another one, they merge together, and then they continue. I suspect that there are tiny drops of water present, or the drops themselves are elongated enough that their respective surfaces are merging, and that merge goes all the way up into the faucet or tap. This creates a cylindrical column of flowing water molecules, aka, or otherwise known as, Dom's continuous stream of water. This is called laminar flow, and it's all due to the surface tension of the water. This is used to great effect in the animated film A Bug's Life. Thank you, Another Postcard.
Well, that was wonderful. It was succinct.
Yeah.
It told us everything we needed to know, Dom.
Yeah.
And it's just solidified your genius in some ways.
Yes, I think so. Now, I don't know, should we do one more?
Go on, Tom.
Regarding spooky movies, this is from Deborah on YouTube.
Yeah.
She asks, what is the scariest movie that came from the 1970s? They were less graphic, leaving more to the imagination. I think they work better that way. First of all, for her, is The Exorcist. Second is Black Christmas. Third is The Sentinel. I've not seen Black Christmas or The Sentinel.
Exorcist is scary though.
Exorcist is the scariest film of the 70s for me. And then is Rosemary's Baby from the 70s?
I would think.
Or is
so,
it?
Though.
Yeah, I think Rosemary's Baby.
And what's the one with this is gonna be Welcome to My World of the Vague, I'm afraid here. See if you can get this one. It's got an actor in it.
Yeah, is it Don't Look Now?
Is it a girl with a red dress? A red jacket?
It's Don't Look Now.
How did you get that? The only clue I gave you was it's got an actor in it. Well done, Don.
Yeah, points on the board. Yeah, Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie, little girl drowns, they go to Venice, terrifying. How did I know?
But we've never really spoke about that film. Wow, how did you know?
I don't know. Sometimes you just know.
Hiring right now is hard. No one is more committed to helping businesses than Indeed. That's why they're giving away $50 million in Indeed sponsorship job credits to help businesses like yours hire great people fast.
In the minute I've been talking to you, and Billy's been talking to you, 16 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data, worldwide. When you sponsor an Indeed post in the US, you're 3 times more likely to get a hire, according to Indeed data. The right candidate is doing everything they can to find you, and if you use Indeed, you can be sure you're doing everything you can to find them, too. Finding great talent doesn't have to be a second job. You can hire faster and better with Indeed.
Dom, as you know, Indeed makes it super easy because everything happens in one place. Virtual interviews, that saves you time. You can message, schedule, interview top talent seamlessly, all in one place. Indeed saves you headaches. Interview virtually, no downloads, plugins or purchases. You can do it all in one place with Indeed.
Even better, Indeed's the only job site where you only pay for applications that meet your must-have requirements. Indeed is an unbelievably powerful hiring partner, delivering 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to Talent Nest 2019. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast.
Sign up for Indeed now and get $75 credit towards your first sponsored job. Plus, earn up to $500 extra in sponsorship job credits with Indeed's virtual interviews. Visit Indeed.com/onion to learn more. Claim your credits at Indeed.com/onion. Indeed.com/onion. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Sweaty sack summer is approaching, and it's time for you to prioritise the comfort of your crotch. That's why the kings of crotch comfort, Manscaped, have spent 2 years designing the most comfortable boxer briefs out there. Now, I have had the honour of testing out these new boxers, and I can tell you that they have the softest fabric of any underwear. They are incredibly breathable, so comfortable, fantastic. You know, Manscaped have even trademarked the dual pouch, so you know that they're serious about it. I think it's time for you to invest in your family jewels. So, just let everything breathe down there and get 20% off plus free shipping by using the code ONION at manscaped.com.
I very much enjoy their Lawnmower 4.0, the best electric trimmer for below-the-waist grooming. This trimmer offers skin-safe technology designed to trim hair on loose skin. Also, the tagless waistband of the boxer shorts hugs your body without digging in, and it lays flat against your skin to reduce chafing. There's a front fly that gives easy access and makes bathroom breaks quick and efficient. And you can choose from an arrangement of designs and colors and sizes from small to 3 times extra large for all you guys out there.
Get 20% off and free shipping with the code ONION at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code ONION at manscaped.com. Once you try the new Boxers 2.0, you'll never go back.
We're going to do the guest, but I want to talk about the moustache because it links to the guest. Were you going to talk about the guest?
I was going to talk about a guest and also why I'm not involved with the guest. Not involved. I'm not involved in the interview because you did a fantastic job, Dom. I hope you don't mind me saying like a young Terry Wogan.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, great.
Or a Parkinson at the top of his game.
Yeah.
Now, and our guest this week is Perry Pinkhurst, who is a fighter pilot. Now, why would we have a fighter pilot on at this time?
The answer is the film Top Gun Maverick, which you recently saw and I recently saw, and you really, really had an enjoyable time in the cinema. Just talk us through that a little bit.
Dom, I loved it. I cannot tell you how much I loved it because the number would be too high. Mm. But it was the weirdest experience I've ever had at a cinema as well.
Why?
I sat down, here, I'll tell you why, Dom. I sat down and the first sort of scene started, right? And it's Maverick, he's got all these friends, And they're all, I don't want to waste or spoil the film, but this is the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes we're talking about here. He is in a program where they've got this new fighter plane that they want to get to Mach 10, which is 10 times the speed of sound.
Wow.
Mach 10. And if you remember the dialogue, this is all guys who have been working together for years on this. The dialogue was the main guy saying, right, they're going to cancel this if we don't get to Mach 10.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have to get to 10.1, but we have to get to... And I was just thinking, everybody in this room knows that. You do not have to say that. This is just exposition, which, as you know, and it's not great for a script.
Yeah.
Just people who already have information telling the information to the audience. So I was ready to switch off, Tom. I thought, no, I'm not going to buy this. And then Maverick got in that plane. Nobody thought he was going to get to 10, Tom. Nobody thought it. They were only even going to go for 9 that day. And he just pushed the handle and it got to 10. Oh. And then, Tom, he didn't pull it back. He went 10.1. And the main guy who told us they had to get to 10, he went, oh, see that, Maverick. He didn't say that, but he said it in his eyes.
Yeah.
And then that Maverick, he pushed it 10.2. The whole thing's gone at 10.3. I was like, I'm in. I am 100% into this movie. And from that moment on, Tom, I loved it. I sat in that chair myself and I was weeping at parts. I was cheering. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, you sent a message again to the Hobbits saying that you couldn't remember a time where you enjoyed a film as much in the cinema. And you've been waxing lyrical about it since. It's an incredible popcorn movie. It gives you everything that you want and shamelessly just kind of says, we're just going to throw everything at you. The kitchen sink, we don't care. We love fighter planes. We love Tom Cruise's Maverick. We're going to give you everything.
Exactly. And not in a sort of subtext way. It's just all, they're just saying, look, we're doing this now because we want you to cry at this point. And I'm like, I can see you doing that and I'm crying at this point. I just loved it. I thought Tom Cruise was brilliant. I can't think of another actor who could play that part now. Like, he's like old school movie star.
Yeah.
You don't really get now that could play Maverick, you know?
Yeah.
It was just brilliant.
An unabashed matinee idol. He's like, not only am I doing a sequel to...
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A film that really put me on the map when I was in my early 20s, but now I'm so big and I'm so brash and out there that I'm going to call the sequel me. It's Top Gun, me. The whole thing, the cameras are pointing directly at me. Now get some of me into your system.
Now who's driving the plane? Me. Who's everybody talking about? Me. If there's a beautiful woman, who is she in love with? Me. And I loved it too.
Now I'm going to say something controversial, not only controversial but so controversial that when I put forward this point to you, you just ignored it. You flat out ignored it. You didn't even respond to it.
The controversial
comment from me is, love Top Gun Maverick, still prefer the original.
Is that why you've grown a goose moustache?
There's a goose moustache. Well, the goose moustache is very trendy right now because, I mean, obviously Anthony Edwards did it in the original and then you've got Miles Teller doing it. I think the moustache is going to make a comeback into the hot, hot summer months. I think it's going to be moustache time.
I might grow one.
Do? Yeah? You couldn't grow one right now for your job, right?
No. But it's almost finished and I've never had a moustache.
I'll grow on you. You had an amazing beard when you played Banquo, but I'd love to see it with a moustache. You didn't explain to the audience why you couldn't make the interview. So explain that, and then we'll bring on Terry.
I'd love to explain that, Tom. But I think it was just as simple as Terry was coming in. We thought that Terry. I could do it. Terry?
It's Terry Pankhurst, not Perry Tankhurst. Terry Pankhurst.
Hold on, if this is Johnny. Oh. Terry. Terry. Sorry, John. I think I said Perry at the start. Remember that?
You didn't. You said Terry Pinkhurst at the start, and I didn't correct you. It's Terry Pankhurst. We're keeping all this in. John, make a note. We're keeping all this in. We're not trying to offend Terry. We're just trying to make people realize how wrong Billy can get names so often.
But I never met Terry. And then
congrats
John again. John did actually send me the correct name.
Yeah,
and I have written it down incorrectly.
Yeah, that's a shame.
He wrote Terry Pankhurst.
Whose call sign was Spanky, because obviously Panky. Oh, that's a shame. Yeah.
What's that say?
Well, that says the entomologist, unfortunately. So
come on!
Keep this in, John. Keep it all in. It's gold. Anyway, you were on set is basically what you're trying to say, right? You were at work.
Yeah, yeah. So sadly, we were hoping that I was going to finish in time to be able to come over and speak to Terry. But as things went, I couldn't get off set. So you very kindly, Dom, says, let me do the heavy lifting here.
I don't want you to worry because I asked him all the questions that I think you would ask, which is, you know, what does it feel like to have all those G-forces on you? What does it feel like to eject out of a plane? Does anyone ever hit the brakes and fly right by? I asked all of those classic questions. So why don't we bring on Terry right now? So, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined now by Terry Pankhurst, who looks like he wrote this bio, and I was just reading it, and it's fantastic. So before I ask you a ton of crazy fighter jet questions, Terry, I'm just going to read your bio because it's fascinating. Grew up on a farm in Irondale, Missouri. Graduated high school in 1988, in college in December 91 with a degree in aviation tech. And then you put here mostly aircraft mechanical stuff. Wanted to be a commercial pilot, but with a terrible market for commercial aviation after the first Gulf War, chances of that were nearly non-existent. So joined the, tried to join the Air Force or Naval Aviation. Navy came through, was sworn in and checked into Aviation Officer Candidate School 1992 after 5 months of Marine drill instructors and loads of PT, physical training. Graduated, got married, headed to primary flight training at Corpus Christi in Texas. After primary, selected jets and headed to Kingsville, Texas for intermediate and advanced strike training. Received my wings of gold April 95. Headed to San Diego, California for training in the S-3B Viking. Damn. Flew the Viking for nearly 4 years on many deployments to faraway places. In February 2000, went to training command to teach the next generation of naval aviators. Literally maverick. Taught on the T-45 Goshawk for the next 12 years after retiring in May 2012. Taught in the T-45 simulator for several years and have a T-45 maintenance test pilot for over 8 years now. Two daughters from your late wife. Sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Two stepdaughters, three grandchildren, still play video games, think dad jokes are a necessary second language. And then you wrote here at the bottom, there's so much more. I've probably gone on too long. Let me know if you need anything else. It was perfect, Terry. It was perfect.
Thank you, sir.
Man, what a life. Now, it seems from your bio here that you are now currently retired from the Navy or not. Are you still working?
I am retired from the Navy as of May 2012, but I fly as a civilian contract pilot. So I work for Vertex Aerospace. They maintain the aircraft. When they do work on them, I take them out and test fly them to make sure they actually are fixed. And if they are, I sign them off and put them back in service.
Wow. So you're test flying planes to make sure that everything's okay after they
at one point were not okay. So you're literally the guinea pig to see if things are working again.
I never thought of it that way, but I guess so.
So they kind of say, hey, Terry, yeah, it's fine. You can go up. But just in case, if things do go bad, we've got the right men here. That's the idea, that you could troubleshoot in the air.
They do good work, and I've not had to troubleshoot too much very often.
When you fly commercially, do you tell people as you're getting on that you're also a pilot, just in case something happens, or do you keep that to yourself?
No, I don't do that, but I'd be a little bit, I guess, arrogant.
Right.
But, I did fly briefly in a commuter airline, flying Embraer 145s, those little commuter jets, the one that has one set of seats on one side and two on the other.
Yeah.
And I did that for a few months before I realized that just wasn't my life.
Was it a little monotonous, backwards and forwards? What did you not like about that?
Yeah, it's driving the bus. You do a lot of spend a lot of time pre-flighting, putting stuff into the flight computer, and monitoring the autopilot.
Right.
And that's just not something I really got behind.
But just to confirm, Terry, if you were on a plane and both the pilots had the chicken and you had the shrimp and the chicken, the chicken was
nice
not
reference.
Great. Yeah. They could, you could put your hand up and say, well, I can fly this plane and land it. You could do that with any plane out there.
I could probably figure it out.
Love that. I want to be on planes with you for the foreseeable future.
Fresh from San Diego, California comes the only sunglasses brand I'm ever going to wear again. I'm talking about Blenders Eyewear, and you're going to be just as hooked when you see just how cool these shades are. I have an amazing pair of sunglasses. I keep it in my car. They help me from getting too much sun around my eyes. When I've got my window down, people go, hey, cool guy, what's your name? And I say, shut your face, I'm wearing sunglasses.
Chase Fisher started Blenders by selling his beachy shades out of a backpack while doubling as a surf instructor on Pacific Beach. His goal was to create adventurous, mid-priced eyewear option with the same cool factor as the leading styles. And unlike expensive big brand shades that you probably lost or smashed at the beach, Blenders are actually affordable. So you're not going to cry as much when the inevitable happens.
Mm-hmm. Billy does break a lot of sunglasses. Blenders team of in-house designers are constantly coming out with new styles, from orange polarized wraparounds to tortoiseshell frames with purple lenses to classic gold arms on black lenses. And it's not just sunglasses. Blenders has prescription glasses, readers and blue lights, as well as snow collection with goggles and accessories. Live life in forward motion with Blenders today.
To score 15% off your Blenders purchase, visit blenderseyewear.com and enter the promo code OnionVIP. That's blenderseyewear.com, code OnionVIP for 15% off.
Wren is a startup that's making it easy for everyone to make a meaningful difference in the climate crisis. Right now, they're focused on monthly subscriptions where you can calculate your carbon footprint and offset it by supporting awesome climate projects that plant trees, protect rainforests, and remove CO2 from the sky. Their goal is to unlock the collective action of millions of individuals to drive the systemic change needed to end the climate crisis.
So Dom and I have been talking about this for quite a few years now, and we've done lots of stuff over the years to try and help offset our carbon footprint. I know we have planted a lot of trees, especially in Scotland, but all over, and been involved lots of different companies. And Wren really make it easy and simple, which is a great thing, to help you offset your carbon footprint.
Wren is a website where you can calculate your personal carbon footprint based on your lifestyle, then offset it by funding projects that plant trees, protect rainforests, and sequester CO2, and more. Signing up for Wren is an easy way to do something meaningful about the climate crisis. Wren practices hyper-transparency. Once you sign up to make a monthly contribution to offset your carbon footprint, you'll receive monthly updates about the tree planting, rainforest protection, and carbon removal projects you're funding. You can even see the exact coordinates of the trees you've planted. Fantastic!
It's going to take all of us to end the climate crisis. Do your part today by signing up for Wren. Go to wren.co/onion. Sign up and they'll plant 10 extra trees in your name. That's wren.co/onion. Start making a difference. Thank you, Wren.
Well, Terry, what we do like to do on these shows is ask people kind of their origin story, because who knows, maybe there is a young girl or a young boy out there that would love to be doing the job that you do. So we'd love to kind of take that back and find out where that came from. So you grew up on a farm in Missouri. Were you fascinated with planes from a young age?
Very young age. In fact, I would have to say where it really sparked in me was, I don't know if you are familiar with a show starring Robert Conrad back in the late 70s called Baba Black Sheep or Black Sheep Squadron.
No, I do not know that show. So tell me about that show.
Oh, I'm dating myself. And they flew the F4U Corsair. And that's my favorite plane in the entire universe right there. Mm-hmm. But it was a story following the exploits of Pappy Boeington and the Black Sheep Squadron. Of course, highly fictionalized.
Yeah.
But they went on missions every week. They had their standard enemies and stuff, and they flew the Corsair and did all kinds of cool stuff. And I just fell in love with aviation right then, especially that particular airplane.
Right. So how old were you when you watched that show, and how quickly did you start to put things into place to think, I want to be a pilot?
Probably about the time I was 12 or so, I really started to feel that I wanted to start pushing that way. I started feeling the need to, or the urgency to get started along that path. So my mom and dad knew this. They took me to a local airport and showed me the airplanes, got to talk to some of the old pilots and stuff. And basically they told me how much it would cost to get your private pilot's license. In the early 80s, that was about, I don't know, probably $1,500 or so.
Right.
My mom and dad thought that would discourage a 12-year-old, but what it did is it gave me a goal.
Yeah, $1,500.
So I started, mowing lawns and doing all kinds of other chores and raised almost all of that money. Fast forward to 1987, early 87, and I had money amassed and I wanted to really go ahead and give it a try. So we went back to the airport and I was going to sign up for lessons and stuff, and an older gentleman in the corner pulled me to the side, my mom and dad as well, and said, the best way to do this, if you want to do it as a group, as a family, is to buy yourself one of the older airplanes and everyone get their license. And if you don't want to keep the airplane, sell it at the end, because airplanes have a tendency to keep their value if you take care of them. You can sell them for as much or more than you bought them for. So believe it or not, my parents got on board with that, and we ended up buying a plane. An old 62 Cessna 172.
So that's little kind of 5-seater, 7-seater type plane. How many people can sit?
It's only 4.
Okay.
It's a very simple airplane. Okay. Fixed pitch prop, fixed gear, the whole bit.
Right. So you buy the plane, and then you're looking for someone to teach you how to fly that plane. The entire family, your mom, dad, and yourself.
Yes, sir. We got an older instructor, been around for a good while, but knew all the tricks, I guess, and we paid him by the hour to teach us in that airplane. I got my license in about 5 months. Mom and Dad took a little bit longer, but we all three ended up getting a private license.
Wow! And how old were you when you got your license? You just graduating high school, is that right?
Oh, 17.
So, and that's the youngest that you can get it? 16, 17 times?
17 for the license. You can solo when you're 16, though.
Wow. So you get your pilot's license and you graduate from high school. And then what is your path? And is that the normal path that most people are taking to be a pilot?
No, that's probably not really the normal path. Speaking from the military side, most people show up to primary training with no previous experience. So I was a little bit of an anomaly there.
Yeah.
If you're going commercial aviation, straight to the airlines, then yeah, that's probably how you do it. You get your private license, work your way up through your ratings, become an instructor yourself in small planes, build your hours, and then finally get picked up when you have enough at some small twin engine outfit maybe. And then from there, you'd go to the commuter airlines, and from there, you'd go to the majors.
So you came in to the Navy already as a pilot, which most people would have to have that rudimentary training. Is that correct?
Right, and it was very helpful through primary training. By the time you get to jets, it really is a different world, though. So it really doesn't buy you much of anything there.
Yeah.
So much of that training is procedural and instrument flight, which I didn't have a whole lot of.
Right.
And that pretty much leveled the playing field from intermediate and advanced.
Yeah, I'm sure. And then I'm reading here, it says you wrote that you had 5 months of Marine drill instructors and lots of physical training. So let's just go into that a little bit. This is the kind of model where they're trying as hard as they can to see if you will be able to take orders, what your mental strength is like alongside your physical strength. But could you just flesh that out a little bit, what that's about?
I'll do my best. There is a movie with Richard Gere from way back called An Officer and a Gentleman.
Yes,
that
it's
is
a great
supposed
one.
To be AOCS. And that's fairly close, I suppose, but it's not quite as loose, I guess, as that movie might have been. Plus, it doesn't take place in Washington State. At that time, AOCS was in Pensacola, Florida.
Right.
The physical part of that's probably pretty close. I think at one point I was averaging running anywhere from 8 to 9.5 miles a day from different stuff.
Right.
There's also academics involved. And yes, the drill instructors would treat you, to say the least, very poorly to make sure you really want this. You got to remember, you've got guys with 4-year college degrees. And if they can survive this program, they're going to get commissioned and they're going to go to flight school. Mm. They need to know that it's really worth that to you. Right. It's like I had it described to me as holding on to the tailgate of a truck while they're trying to stomp your fingers and make you let go.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say my class started with 27 and we finished with 12. And that was about the average.
Right. Okay. So they're generally looking to cut it in half at the least type thing. And it's as much as a mental game as it is a physical game, right? I mean, throughout the day, you're obviously doing a lot of physical stuff. But
absolutely right.
But really, the instructors are trying to say, they're trying to see, can they handle the mental torture that we're putting on top of the physical torture?
Yes, very much so. Right. Very much.
I mean, I remember Richard Gere in An Officer and a Gentleman just constantly saying over and over again that he wasn't going to quit. That's all they're trying to make you do is quit, right? They're like, go ring the bell, go quit. It's fine. You can have a hot meal and, you know, sleep in a nice bed for however long you want. And because the enemy, the quote unquote enemy, they're going to be way crueler than the drill instructors. That's what they're trying to drill into you, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so you do the physical training. Is it a fail pass type thing, or is it just the people that get to the end pass?
Well, I'd say fail pass. I mean, if you can't do the runs, you can drop out. At that time, you could drop out of 3 runs, and over a 4-month period, that's a lot of runs. Mm. And if you dropped out of more than that, then you would go on probation. If you dropped out again, you're probably out.
Right.
It was pretty pretty strict.
Okay, so you pass that, and then from there, what happens after the 5 months with the Marine drill instructors?
Then you go to primary training, and there's 2 places for that in the Navy. One is near Pensacola, Florida, Whiting Field, and the other is Corpus Christi, Texas, NES Corpus. There, at that time, we would go fly a plane called the T-34 Mentor, and nowadays it's the T-6 Texan II. And then depending on how you do out of that program, how your grades are, and what's available, needs of the Navy, you put a dream sheet in as to what you want to go fly, whether it's helicopters or large wing aircraft or what they call strike, which is anything that goes on board the carrier.
Mm.
And depending on your grades and needs of the Navy and availability, you get what you can.
Right.
So I selected Jets Kingsville and was able to go down there for my intermediate and advanced training.
So that's intermediate and advanced fighter jet training. Yeah.
Right. If you want to be more specific, you'd call it strike training because you also include in that, non-fighter aircraft. I flew the S-3 Viking, which is not a fighter aircraft.
Mm.
It is a surface control aircraft. I would hunt surface ships and submarines.
Mm.
And of course, the E-2 Hawkeye, you're probably familiar with, has the large spinning dome on top.
Yeah.
And then, of course, nowadays, it's pretty much, it's some flavor of Hornet or the F-35 Charlie.
Mm. And generally, is there usually a kind of a thing that the best people in the class all want to do? Like, do the best generally all want to be kind of at the sharper edge of the weapon, kind of doing the fighter jet stuff?
Yeah. Some people have their own specific desires. Some people, maybe if they don't want quite as dynamic a flying, might try to go, well, in my day, S-3 Vikings or E2 Hawkeyes. I did want to fly a Hornet or a Tomcat, but didn't quite have the grades compared to the other guys I finished with, so I ended up in the S3s, which turned out to be a great deal.
Yeah.
But no, I'd be lying if I said I chose that first. So once again, it comes down to your grades.
Right, and to be flying the Tomcats, you need to be like the best in the country type thing.
The Tomcat, believe it or not, you had to be good at landing on the ship. It's one of the harder ones to bring aboard.
Yeah.
The second one was actually one called the EA-6B Prowler. That one was equally as hard. So if you had really good boat grades, if everything else is really good, you might find yourself in a EA-6B Prowler because of that. So kind of a double-edged sword doing good at the boat the first time.
That's the classic kind of landing on the aircraft carrier, and it has the little bungee cord that kind of grabs hold of the plane.
Oh, yes.
That still happens to this day. That's not just a Top Gun cheesy thing.
Oh, that is absolutely real. We have kids going to the boat this week.
So the G-forces on just landing a plane like that, because you're coming in relatively fast and then it's grabbing hold of you very quickly and bringing you to a halt very quickly. What's the G's in the landing process? Do you know?
I'm not sure exactly what the G's are. My guess would be probably only about four if I had to put a number to it. But you're going from 150 mile per hour roughly to zero in about, I don't know, 3-4 seconds.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, you know, most people are not ever experiencing that unless they've done something really wrong with their car and they're in a fast car, you know.
Yeah, good point.
Well, let's talk about life on an aircraft carrier. If you're stationed out on an aircraft carrier as a pilot, how much time are you generally actually out on that ship?
Okay, every aircraft carrier has assigned to it an air wing. An air wing is comprised of several different squadrons, usually located at different places in the country. Most of our Hornet squadrons are divided between California, Lemoore, and Oceana in Virginia. And our Growlers, which are the electronic warfare Hornets, are up in Washington State, and various other places for some of the other aircraft. Anyway, the air wing is put together by squadrons from each of these locations, and they come together at the beginning of what we call the workup cycle. And that usually begins up in Fallon, Nevada, which, by the way, is where Top Gun is actually located these days.
Uh-huh.
It used to be Miramar, but for 20-something years, it's been Fallon, Nevada.
I can't believe Tom Cruise got something wrong. That's outrageous.
Well, actually, they covered it pretty well in the movie because he wasn't going to Top Gun. He was going to meet Top Gun graduates at North Island, which is where I was stationed in S3s for a while.
That is true. We'll get into Top Gun at some point, don't worry. But please go on.
All righty. Anyway, so the air wing gets together, and they start doing the rudimentary stuff that makes them become a team. Everything from air-to-air refueling to going on simple missions, progressively harder missions, until the entire air wing works together like a, you know, well-oiled machine.
Mm-hmm.
Then they take this well-oiled machine and they take it to the carrier for a workup cycle, usually off the coast of, maybe around Puerto Rico or off the coast of Carolina or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's usually 4 or 5 weeks long, where once again, you start out with basic, you know, carrier operations, you know, get back to the basics of landing on the ship and taking off and going through those cycles. And then you start introducing more and more simulated war games. Then you come back off the ship for a little while longer. Ship goes through some final preparations, as does the air wing. Get together for one more of those exercises, usually 3 or 4 weeks long. And then you are certified by NAVAIR, I think, to actually go on cruise at that point. You're fully up and ready, if you will.
Right.
Then you go on cruise usually for 6 to 7 months if there isn't any trouble in the world. And then you come home and go on some downtime, and then you start the whole cycle again after a few months.
So in those times when you're away for 6 to 7 months and there isn't any, you know, real major trouble, you're going out on exercises at that point. You're replicating trouble, is that right?
Pretty much, yeah. The fighters will go high and do cat missions. They'll often play with other foreign powers. The French like to play with us a lot, so nice. The Brits. So we'll do war games with each other just to, you know, keep each other sharp. Flying S3s, my job was to paint a picture of every surface ship out there and assess their threat and, if necessary, prosecute. Though that in the Mediterranean, where I did my cruises, that wasn't really all needed that much. The closest I came to firing on a ship was during Kosovo in 99, when Milosevic, if you might remember that whole thing, he left his Navy in port. We basically told him if he came out of port, you know, we would take him out. And yeah. he never even fired up the boilers, so.
And did he have a large Navy in comparison to what you guys were threatening him with?
No. Oh, not even close. Not really.
Right.
It would just be posturing if he came out.
I mean, very often it does seem to be that in modern day warfare is a lot of posturing, right? It's like, well, look, have a look at what we've got. We're massive. And have a look at what you've got. You're not that big. Let's just have a nice right. compromise here.
Yeah, political stuff and ROE, rules of engagement, play a lot in that. And it's not uncommon for the little guy, if you want to call it that, to rattle their sabers, as the term goes, right next to the mark that we've drawn, just to show that they to the world that they, quote unquote, stood up to the big guy.
Right, right. I was filming in Ukraine about 8 or 9 years ago. We were in the Crimea region, which is obviously southern Ukraine, and in a few of the restaurants that we had eaten at that were on the kind of coastline harbor there, the people working in the restaurants would point out, oh, there was a Russian submarine kind of coming up to the surface over there a few weeks ago and over there a few weeks ago. And again, it's just a way of kind of saying, hey, we're just letting you guys know we're here, not going to do anything, but we are here, and, you know, just deal with it.
Right.
Yeah, crazy. All right, well, let's talk Top Gun, because you graduated high school in 1988. I believe the original Top Gun came out in 1987. So
86.
So Terry, you're right in it. You're, what are you, 13, 14 when Top Gun came out, something like that?
16.
Oh man, yeah. Come on.
Old guy.
Man, that must have been a crazy film for you. I just recently saw, so I had friends come up to stay with me this weekend. Friday night, we watched what we're now coining OG, original gangster Top Gun, and then we watched the new Top Gun Saturday morning at the cinema. I mean, similar to the Karate Kid, because when I was a kid, I joined a karate class and did it for, you know, kind of a year or two, and the instructors said, every time the Karate Kid is on the TV, we get 50% extra people in our classes. These Top Gun films must be so influential in your particular field of work. Does it get in any way annoying where people are like, oh, so who's your Iceman and who's your Maverick?
Well, there's a lot of misconceptions that Top Gun has kind of brought about for the Navy, but I want to say both movies are fantastic.
Agree.
Most naval aviators really love them, but you have to leave reality at the door. But they're both fantastic movies. Especially this last one, I was pretty blown away by Tom Cruise referred to as a love letter to aviation.
Yeah.
He was right.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The way they frame the aircraft, the way the aircraft are taken off, the way they perform in these skirmishes.
Right.
Even every level of transport, the way he rides motorcycles, the way he drives car. It is a real love letter. I had watched some YouTube kind of breaking some of these myths about original Top Gun and the new Top Gun, and this pilot had said, you know, the way that they coined the term bogey is completely incorrect, because a bogey is essentially an unidentified aircraft. We don't know where they're from.
Right.
But as soon as they're identified, they are now no longer a bogey. They're something else. Is that correct?
A bandit.
A bandit. Right. Okay. So I think maybe they say bandit in this recent film, but in the previous one, everything's a bogey, and that's not right, right?
Right. Well, they had several things in the first one that you kind of had to roll your eyes at. And one of the biggest ones that always bothered me, when Maverick is fighting Jester, and Jester is, quote unquote, you know, diving below the hard deck to get away.
Yeah.
The hard deck is the simulated ground.
Okay.
Jester flew into the ground and Maverick follows him. So Maverick commits suicide, essentially.
Oh, come on,
as
Maverick.
As far as the engagement is concerned, that's exactly what happened.
Okay, yeah, that's not cool.
And that would have been Maverick's kill had he just not gone below the deck himself.
Tom Cruise messing it up again. The other thing in the first Top Gun that doesn't make any sense. I mean, first of all, the inverted, you know, giving the bird to the enemy thing is just so unsafe that you would immediately be court-martialed and never work again. But he's using a Polaroid camera with a flash, so the glare from his screen would not show up the enemy. I want to ask you this because I've never had the opportunity to ask someone with your level of qualifications. The way that Goose unfortunately passes away in the original Top Gun, spoiler alert if you've not seen it, but it is 30 years ago.
Who hasn't?
Could that be an accurate way that a pilot might succumb to serious injury or death?
Well, it would take a mechanical malfunction. Now, the movie kind of makes you think that somehow he did something wrong because Maverick says, watch the canopy. Well, there's no control over that. It's completely automated. When you pull that handle, that canopy flies first, and then within less than, I think, 1.5 seconds, both seats are out of the jet.
Right.
So Goose had no control over that. So saying watch the canopy doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it's kind of a hero thing for Tom Cruise's character to say. But yeah, he doesn't. There would be no examples previously of people having watched the canopy and stayed safe or not watched it and died. Yeah.
Right. It'd have to be a mechanical malfunction of some kind.
Right. How often throughout a average calendar year would you guess pilots are jettisoning their planes? It's not common, right?
No, it's not common at all. If you ever look at, you can look this up online, at the mishap rate in the Navy, you'll see a geometric curve downward to, back in the 50s, they were losing a plane almost every day somewhere in the Navy, to the point now where we probably lose, knock on wood, 20 or so maybe in a year.
Right.
So I wouldn't... the human factor that's in there is usually, unfortunately, what happens.
Yeah.
Either someone didn't react quick enough or they did something that they might or they shouldn't have.
Right.
But every once in a while, you do have catastrophic failures.
Yeah.
And I did like in Top Gun Maverick where they had the bird strike. That actually happens fairly often.
Yeah, happens on commercial jets as well, right? Commercial planes.
It does.
Yeah.
I've hit a few birds. Fortunately, nothing catastrophic. Goshawk only has one engine, so if it went down the intake, it's probably toast.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy. Now, if you're a pilot that has found yourself in a position where you have ejected from a plane twice, is that kind of the end of your career?
There actually is a limitation, but it's more medical than anything else. When you eject from the aircraft, all joking aside, you actually lose maybe a half inch on your height because it compresses your spine so bad.
Damn.
So there are probably limitations that on how many ejections you can have and still be allowed to fly ejection seat aircraft.
Wow. So the average fighter pilot coming towards the end of their career, are they exhibiting relatively similar injuries? Do you have problems with your spine? Do you have problems with your neck? Or does G-force bring in any kind of common injuries?
G-force can. When you're in control of the aircraft, you pull heavy Gs, you're ready for it. You're in a good position for it. When you're teaching students and they suddenly decide to pull without really telling you or at some unexpected point, it can catch you. If you're looking slightly off to the side, it can tweak your neck pretty bad.
Right.
Most guys who teach ACM, air combat maneuvering in the aircraft, or BFM as we call it now, basic fighter maneuvers, 2 or 3 years, if you can go that whole time without having a real neck injury, you're probably doing good.
Wow. Wow. And in that fighter training stuff that goes up with real planes in the sky, would it be fair to say that what we're seeing in both of these Top Gun films is way closer than it would be in the exercises that you guys do? Because if you clip a wing, you can kill someone easily, right?
Well, we fly very close to each other. Now, when Maverick flies between the formation and surprises them, okay, yeah, that's
it's cavalier.
I can't possibly imagine that happening. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Got to give it that.
Yeah.
But no, you really wouldn't want to do something like that because if anyone moves at the last second, you're going to take everyone with you.
Right. I mean, it is quite Maverick. It's quite a Maverick move, and
it is.
You know, he
and part of me says that is so cool.
He's living up to
I'm
his
gonna
name.
Go with that.
My friends and I on Friday night when we were watching the original one, my friend Will and I said, because this is kind of a fun exercise the next time you watch the original Top Gun. Watch the original Top Gun with a view of objectively trying to decide whether or not Maverick is kind of a dick in the first film. Because he is objectively kind of a dick. Do you know what I mean? He's a nice guy, whatever. He's a handsome dude. Everyone likes him. He's got that, you know, cocky arrogance. But he's not very nice to his fellow pilots. He puts Goose in an extraordinary amount of danger and threat of being dismissed like three or four times just because he wants to like do a flyby and
taters.
He's not nice to Charlie.
Right.
He's disrespectful to his instructors. You know, in the final exercise where they bring him back and he goes up with ice and, you know, he bugs out for a second. I would assume even though he comes back and quote unquote saves the mission, the fact that he bugged out for a moment would mean, okay, thanks, but you're done. That's your career over.
Yeah, it could be. That's another thing is really only a Hollywood setting.
Right.
Because, engagements last, honestly, about 45 seconds to 2 minutes tops.
Mm-hmm.
So those critical few seconds where he's off trying to talk to me, Goose, ice is already dead.
Right, right. Yeah, because he's being ganged up on that point.
Right, but I got the same feeling about his character, too, because in this business, the number one thing you have to have with everyone is trust.
Right.
You have to trust that they are going to have your back.
Right, right.
And that's paramount. So, yes, you're absolutely right on that call.
Yeah. Now, the thing about locking on and tone and all this kind of stuff. So when you're locking on, that's trying to get the missile that you're carrying underneath your plane to tell you that if you were to fire it at this point, there's a very strong chance that it would lock on to the plane that's in front of it, correct?
Right. Most missiles have what's called initial homing, where you lock it and tell it where to go. And then once it gets close enough to its target, depending on what type of a sensing unit it's using, whether it's heat or whatever, then it goes on what's called terminal homing, where it's taking care of it itself.
Right.
And yes, they had a much better heads-up display for the second movie than the first one. The first one was obviously very 80s looking.
Yeah.
But the premise is relatively solid on that.
Now,
if the appearance isn't.
And that tone that Maverick and Goose or whomever else hear in their cockpit, is that tone also heard by the enemy that they've been locked onto?
Oh, no, it's not. They kind of make it seem like it is because when it starts buzzing, they go to the other cockpit. Now, what they are going to hear in their cockpit is we have these things, what's called raw gear, which is basically warning when something has locked on to you.
Okay.
It's kind of like a fuzz buster, in your car.
Yeah.
So their tone may not be the same one, but yes, they would probably know that they were locked on to.
They would hear something. Okay, cool. Now, and what about the science of, or the physics maybe, of hitting the brakes and flying right by? So I was saying to my friend Will over the weekend, I was like, I'm confused. He pushes forward and pulls back. To me, that feels like he wouldn't go up and backwards, but is that correct or not?
Talking about the original Top Gun when he does that
original
fly
Top
right
Gun.
By thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had the throttles backwards on that. He would have pulled them back, popped his speed brakes to slow down as rapidly as possible and pull directly up to also create more parasite drag. Putting it forward, yeah.
So in original Top Gun, if he was doing it right, he would pull back with both hands and then push forward with his feet. Is that right?
Well, the feet are your rudders, so pushing forward wouldn't do anything good. One foot or the other is going to move your rudder left or right. So, yeah, feet would have nothing to do with it, but pulling the throttle back to idle and pulling the stick up to do, they refer to it kind of as a cobra maneuver, if you will,
least
the beginning of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it would allow the other craft to fly right by unless they copy them. But I guess you're supposed to understand he did it so quickly they couldn't respond to
it. Or if they were too close and instead of just flying right by, they just smash right into him.
Exactly. They had to reflexively miss them.
In the second Top Gun film, he gets it more accurate. Is that right? The way that he does the flyby?
He does. The first film, one of the other kind of comical parts of the fighting that they did is you would have one aircraft in front of the other. The one in front would do an aileron roll. Well, that's real pretty. Thanks. And shoot him.
Right.
It doesn't do anything, but it looks good.
Yeah,
it's like
sexy.
That was pretty. Thank you.
Yeah.
Exactly. The real ACM or dog fighting is like a knife fight in a closet.
Mm.
You are trying to get in there as fast as you can behind the other guy, any way it takes. And to do that, you have to fight your jet to the best possible ability.
Mm.
In the T-45, for instance, you have to stay right in the neighborhood of best cornering speed, which I believe is around 300 knots for the Goshawk. If you can maintain that speed and energy and turn a tight circle and outperform the other T-45, you'll eventually end up on their tail and you shoot them.
Right.
That it's not look as good,
yeah,
you know, as aileron rolls and whatnot,
right,
but that's how it actually goes.
That's the more accurate way of doing what you're supposed to do up in the sky. Yeah.
Right. And I think they alluded to that much better in this film.
Yeah.
The second one.
Yeah.
They seem to, you know, seem to do that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm slightly taking the Michael out of the Top Gun films. I absolutely love them. The original Top Gun completely holds up. The second one, we had so much fun at the cinema. I loved so many things about that second film. One of the things that I really liked was when Tom Cruise's character finds himself back in the plane that he flew in the original Top Gun, it does look very dated, doesn't it? It looks kind of like, and even Goose's son, it's like, oh, look at this old dinosaur, or what am I supposed to do with this? But clearly technology moves on so fast, and you must have an acute understanding of just how fast technology moves on, because in the Navy, you're at that finer point of technology, aren't you?
Actually, to be honest, it depends on what part of the Navy you're talking. If you're at the tip of the spear, Super Hornets, F-35, Charlies especially, yeah, you probably have close to the latest and greatest.
Right.
In the old Goshawk, and I even flew an older version of the Goshawk than I'm flying now, technology currently is probably about 30 years old.
Oh, damn.
Probably a Lot 1 Hornet, I guess, would be the closest thing to what we currently have.
Right.
Because that's all you need in the training command.
Uh-huh.
But the closer you get to the tip of the spear, yeah, the better the equipment's going to be.
Now, you were an instructor, is that correct? I'm reading here.
Right. I had an interesting career that way. I flew the S-3 of the fleet, went to the training command in Kingsville, Texas in 2000, February, and started teaching in the T-45 Alpha. And after I was planning on doing a Hornet transition because the S-3 Viking was going away in just a few more years. Well, they had to extend the S-3 Viking's service because the Super Hornets weren't being built fast enough to take over our role as an indigenous air-to-air refueling tanker in time. So they were going to send us back to the fleet to do nothing but pretty much tanking missions, back-to-back-to-back cruises. And I was like, I don't really want to do that.
Right.
So fortunately at the time, though, they came up with a new program that they now call FTS, full-time support, where I became a reservist, but a full-time reservist. So I act the same as an active duty guy, but my whole world just became the training command. So for the next, for a total of 12 years, I taught in the T-45. We have four advanced strike squadrons, and I ended up teaching in all four of them.
And that is literally, you know, for the layman, including myself at home, that is taking pilots up in the sky and putting them through drills.
Yes, sir. Yeah, they've just come from primary, from T-6s or T-34s in the old days, and we teach them the intermediate and advanced syllabus, everything from familiarization, advanced instruments, formation flying, tactical formation, air combat maneuvering. We used to teach air-to-air gunnery and dropping bombs, weapons, and finally culminating with landing aboard the carrier for the first time.
Right. Wow, which I'm sure is extremely scary. Now, to touch upon the original Top Gun for a second, at the start of that film, we witness a pilot, Cougar, essentially going through a kind of anxiety attack in the sky because I think does his plane fly through a jet wash? Is that an actual term for it?
No, he gets the guy behind him. He gets one of those F-5, the F-5 Freedom Fighter that's supposed to be a MiG-28 gets behind him.
Right.
He gets tone. He knows he's locked up, and that causes him to have some type of a breakdown. He looks at a picture of his wife and child,
right.
I guess.
Right. Hopefully it's his wife and child, not just some woman and a kid.
Came with the wallet, you know?
You never know. But now, what I was going to ask you in regards to that was, in your time instructing, were you ever in a situation with a student where you had to talk them down from, you know, going through an amount of anxiety that stopped them from doing their job?
Nothing like that. Okay. I've had a student do what's called G-lock before, which is, you know, totally not their fault. They just weren't prepared for enough G's, and they caused them to momentarily blank out. I took the controls. They recovered. Then we sent that guy off to what they call the centrifuge, which is that thing you've seen on movies before where they spin you around until your eyeballs come out.
Yeah.
He came back good to go. He learned his G tolerance limits and how to affect them better.
So you were in the cockpit behind the guy when he passed out. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yeah, okay. And the instructor.
And obviously, you're both facing the same direction. So the only reason why you knew that he had passed out was because the controls were not being used. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow. For you, obviously, you're conscious, so it's not too scary. But when he came back to consciousness, was he freaked out?
Yeah, there are several moments of disorientation. You don't even know where you are or what's going on.
Sure.
So when that happens, and I've only had to do that once, just started talking to him, just saying, hey, how are you feeling?
Right.
What's your name?
Right.
And ask some basic questions. They come back pretty fast.
Right. Which leads me on to my question about G-force. Obviously, we hear about G-force a lot in these aviation films, and this is the amount of gravity force pushing itself on the human body. Is that correct? And the mind, I guess.
Exactly. 1G is what you're feeling right now.
Yeah.
2Gs would be if you just doubled your weight, and 3Gs is if you tripled your weight, and so forth.
Okay, so it literally makes you double as heavy, triple heavy, quadruple heavy, and
right, exactly.
And suddenly going from being your normal weight to 9 times heavier will do something to the way that your blood moves in your body. Is that correct?
Yeah, it sucks it right out of your head.
So sucks it from your head to your feet. Is that right?
Exactly. It follows gravity. So we wear G-suits or speed jeans, if you want to call them that, and that squeezes our legs and torso to try to slow that effect. There's also maneuvers you can do where you basically tighten everything you've got muscle-wise,
right,
from the waist on down, or really from the chest on down, to try to delay that blood leaving your brain.
So the average, let's say for the sake of argument, the average passenger in a long-haul flight, you're taking off from Los Angeles and you're landing in Sydney. Are they having any experience of G-force? And if so, what would that be?
Probably very little. I'd say commercial airlines, the most you're probably going to experience, unless something's going a little bit wrong, would be maybe 2Gs.
Okay. Now, as you start to ramp that up with your students and with you in your job, you're now pushing into 7, 8, 9, 10 Gs. Is that something that you can deal with?
The Goshawk is limited to 7.3. The Hornet, as they did point out in the newer Maverick movie, I'm glad they acknowledged that when he pulled those 9.5, 10 Gs or whatever, simulating pulling out of that canyon, that he may have trashed that Hornet. I did appreciate that they pointed that out.
So the plane would literally just break apart. If you're in a Goshawk and you find yourself, you know, trying to pull 8 Gs, the plane would just start to break apart. Is that correct?
Well, it probably wouldn't break apart then. You could probably abuse it very badly, but you would have damage around the airplane. You'd have stress points that... So, the plane would have to be torn way down, inspected every part of it. They'd have to do what's called magnafluxing, the metal, to see if it was strained,
right,
and so forth. It would almost be like having to tear down and rebuild the whole airplane.
Right. So that pilot's in trouble if they do that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that would be bad.
Okay. Classically, in these Top Gun films, there's a huge amount of competition. Certainly in the first film, it's quite mean-spirited competition at times. In the second film, there seems to be a little bit more camaraderie. This Top Gun competition, if you will, still continues to happen every year. From your experience, is it a little bit more kind of a group of people supporting each other than a group of people in competition?
It's more people supporting each other, especially at this particular level. And in the fleet, this is going to sound kind of odd, but the highest honors, if you will, or marks on a fitness report, which is what really matters for your next set of orders, doesn't often come down in any way to flight ability. Every landing you make on the ship, they have what's called a greenie board in your ready room. Every landing you make goes on that board for everyone to see. Mm. So if you're the lowest, everybody knows it. If you're the highest, everyone knows it. But that's more just of a pride. But when it comes to advancement, fit reps usually have absolutely nothing to do with that. It has to do with who does their jobs best, who's gotten the quals fast enough or faster than the others, and things like that. But the flying itself really does not weigh in like Top Gun would make you think that it does.
Right, and I'm sure, obviously, with people living in such close quarters with each other, not only going through the training but being on an aircraft carrier, what is also extremely important is your ability to stay good humored and not have a short fuse and things like that, right?
It's not that bad. Going on cruise is like going to summer camp with your best friends. It's just, nice. The only thing that stinks is being away from your family and friends.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on an aircraft carrier, I've never been on an aircraft carrier. I've been lucky enough to be on a submarine that was obviously at the surface when I was in Hawaii, which was a fascinating experience.
Oh.
The confinement of that at Pearl Harbor. I was absolutely fascinated by that. But on an aircraft carrier, What are the more surprising things that you guys have that we might not know about? Is there a bar? Is there a screening room? Is there a pool table?
There is not a bar. There,
it's a shame.
For a screening room, not per se. There are conference rooms and briefing rooms and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny that you should say that, because during Vietnam, when a lot of our guys were captured, the Vietnamese had this idea that the carrier had all kinds of stuff on there, including animals. We must have animals to keep food out there for us, right? Right, so, right, you know, where do you keep the cows? Where do you keep
cows,
the chickens?
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the guys who was captured kept telling him, no, we don't have it. And they kept beating him because they wouldn't believe it. So finally he's like, yeah, fine. Okay. We have the bowling alleys here, that, you know, whatever. He just made up everything he could. He was so tired of them not believing it that he just gave them what they wanted. They wrote it all down. So misconceptions, there are about 5,000 people on that aircraft carrier.
Right.
And when the air wing comes on board, the aircraft carrier sinks about 12 more inches in the water.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, it's about 85 aircraft, I think, roughly.
How fast can an aircraft carrier go when it's going as fast as it can? Do you know?
Nuclear carriers can get in excess of 33 knots, I think, maybe a little faster. I'm not really sure what their outer limit is. But when it's going that fast, the whole thing does shudder a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you said 5,000 people on a fully working aircraft carrier, right? So
right.
Within those 5 or 6 months that you're there, you'll generally get to know most people, certainly by faces, right?
Only usually who you work with. I could have told you who any of the deck crew were from their faces.
Right.
I may not recognize them with their cranials off and such, but I would know them by looking at them.
Right.
And they would know us. And of course, everyone has their own reputation. Most people as high professionals, but a few, not so much. So you always wanted to behave yourself as best as possible so you could get to, you know, they wouldn't do anything dangerous, but you want to make sure that you stay on their good side because they do control your destiny. Nothing like being on the front of that carrier in the pitch black, all your lights are off. You cannot see anything but two wands out in front of you, and you are 2 feet from going over the side of the deck. Mm. And you're really watching them and trusting them to turn you so that you don't do exactly that.
Yeah. Now, there's probably a misconception that, you know, a lot of these fighter pilots are kind of, you know, cocky and arrogant, and I'm sure that the Top Gun films have not necessarily helped that much. Is there this kind of central nucleus of the pilots that are all kind of like, no one really wants to talk to us, everyone's a little bit shy around us type thing?
No, and a common misconception is that they're all egotistical,
right?
But truth be told, whenever you do a mission and you come back, training mission or otherwise, 90% of what you're going to talk about is what you did wrong, because that's the only way you learn from it. There's no point in going over the stuff you did right. If you did it right, then that's great. You have to have a thick skin in this business. If you cannot take constructive criticism, then you are definitely not going to last very long. Also, very important, you don't have to be a self-made martyr, but you do need to own your mistakes. If you don't, people will learn this quickly. And they will, if you're the guy that always has an excuse why it wasn't your fault, they are never going to trust you. So the balance in there is just calling it exactly how it is and learning from your mistakes, owning them.
Right. A little bit of humility, I'm sure. Now, what's this thing that goes on in both of these Top Gun films where when one of the planes takes off from the aircraft carrier, you have guys who are obviously, you know, instructing them what direction to move their wheels in and stuff. And they do like a little dance move thing. They're all kind of like, woohoo, there he went.
You'll sometimes get some eccentric behavior out of some of the controllers, but for the most part, the signals are standardized. And I think I know which one you're talking about. That might have been when they were getting ready to, when they had just launched somebody, and it was maybe a little celebratory thing.
Yeah, I thought maybe because they're so close to such a powerful piece of machinery that is like hurtling down the runway and then out in the sky, maybe they're just so excited. They're like, yay, there he goes, woohoo.
It is kind of a rush. I've stood out on the carrier deck and watched a few launches, and I was a safety officer, so my job was to be out there and make sure these people who always do their jobs are doing it safely. I felt like kind of a hypocrite, but
yeah,
that was my job.
I bet it's a rush. I'm sure it's a rush. There was actually, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I said to my friend this, and it doesn't happen anymore, probably for good reason, but when I first moved to Los Angeles, in the back of these kind of magazines, you know, GQ and Esquire and blah, 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 where the classified ads were, I distinctly remember there was this thing that said, be a Top Gun pilot. And it was for a day, you go out into, I think probably like the Joshua Tree or the Palm Desert or somewhere, and you take off in a plane with a pilot, obviously, and you get the opportunity to quote unquote lock on with your friend in a dogfight. They're obviously staying safe and stuff, but you're the person who decides, you know, when you're going to lock on to your target. They stopped doing that probably because it was incredibly expensive and maybe unsafe. But there was a point where you could do that. I'm sure you...
I remember that.
Yeah, you must have a lot of people in your life saying, well, could you take me up in one of those Top Gun planes? And you're like, no, that's not how this works.
I wish I could, believe me, the number of people I'd love to take.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you go, Terry. I do want to ask you one last question because I've always wondered about this too. The call signs, the nicknames, is that something that you choose, or is that something that is attributed to your personality, or is it totally random?
It is either something you did that is embarrassing,
okay,
or it is just often a play off someone's last names. And the call signs in Top Gun, of course, are a little bit fictional only because they're too kind.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it's usually a little bit of a diss. So your last name is Pankhurst. And is that where your call sign Spanky came from? Because it was Spanky.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
No, yeah, I always think I need to come up with a good story for that. There's, you know, where I end up handcuffed to something. But nah, it's nothing special.
In your time working in the Navy, was there someone with a particular call sign where you were like, damn, that's a cool one. I wish I had that.
Well, I can tell you the funniest one I ever saw was on the side of a Hornet. And this guy's last name, and I apologize to him if he's watching this, but his last name was was Balsitis,
right.
And his call sign was Scroton.
Ah, brilliant. I love it. I love the humor in the
Probably
Navy.
Not PC these days. Probably couldn't get away with that, but you never know.
That's okay. You got to have a sense of humor in all walks of life, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, Terry, it's fantastic to talk to you, fascinating to talk to you. It's brilliant that... we got a chance to talk to someone who's had the life that you've led at a time where the biggest movie on the planet is something that is essentially a love letter to the job that you've done. So it's been really, really fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you, Dom. I sure appreciate it.
Well, Dom, that was fantastic. Look at you. You were on a roll there. That was amazing, that interview. You had me at the edge of my seat.
Yeah, thank you. Does it make you feel like you might want to quit your career and join the Naval Aviators?
Quite a lot. And actually, my son, when he went to see Top Gun Maverick, he wrote to me and he says, yeah, that's what I want to do now.
Wow. So
he's going to be a fighter pilot.
How's his vision? Is it 21-21?
22-22.
Oh, good for Jack. Nice one, Jack. Well, we should say toodle pip to everyone because that fantastic interview with Terry was lovely and weighty and long, and we've ran out of time.
Well, it was fantastic. Well done, Terry, and well done, Dom. That was lovely. I very much enjoyed that.
Thank you, William. As always, if you guys want to get in touch with us, you can get in touch with us at thefrenchybunion@castmedia.com. Send us all your questions. Send us your riddles. Send us your tongue twisters. Send us your places where you think Lord of the Rings trilogy might benefit from a naughty word here and there. Send us ideas for items that you want us to eat from around the world.
And if you guys want to look as cool as Tom Cruise in Top Gun Maverick, wear some merchandise from The Friendship Onion. And you can get that at thefriendshiponionpodcast.com.
Nice. And we will see you guys next week.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
Toodles.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.